Hello, come in. Lie down. Relax. Take a deep breath in. And now breathe out. We'll be your therapists today. You're listening to Triathlon Therapy.
That's too much time. Look at Steve McKenna. Steve, what are you doing, Steve? That's too much time. Advantage Reed.
Triathlon Therapy, we are back, and I'm pretty excited to have one of the greats of the sport, Tim Don, with us. Donnie, as he's affectionately known, is the three-time Olympian, four times ITU world champion in both triathlon and duathlon. He's won countless 70.3 titles, Ironman victories, and at one point actually had the Ironman world record for the fastest male performance up to that point in time. So we are stoked to have you on board. Donnie, I've got Joe Gambles here, RPG coach, and also Clint Rowlings. We haven't had Joe on for a long time, and I thought...
give me a second chance.
Clint's got baby brain. I've got COVID. We needed a third brain just to come up with some questions. So welcome, Donnie.
Hey.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. No, it's always nice to talk triathlon. Cheers, guys.
Well, before we get into triathlon, I'm really excited about the biggest news coming out of UK at the moment with the Oasis getting back together. was that part of your childhood, teenage years?
Oh, definitely, maybe.
Oh, no.
That's no, nice. Definitely. No, of course it was. I mean, yeah, Oasis, yeah. I mean, they're a massive band. Had them blaring when we didn't have, like, when I was in my garage on a shitty turbo trainer with no stimulation. So
nothing gets going like Wonderwall, I guess. So really,
that's it.
Punch out the VO2 session with Wonderwall pumping.
Do you know anyone that's got tickets?
No, I went onto the wait list with a friend, and I didn't get through, and he got through, and it was $900 per ticket. And he was like, nah, I'll just bank on there being a world tour and them coming to Australia. So there's no way in my mind that you have 15 years of beef, squash it all to just do four shows in the UK or whatever it is. Like, they're definitely going to make some proper cash out of it and go around the world, I reckon.
One of them's lost more money than they're letting on. You need to look on that, net worth website, because they're in need of some cash, I reckon.
Donnie, it's so funny. I actually went down that rabbit hole yesterday. But yeah, Liam's pretty much broke, and Noel's killing it. So I think Liam's had to come back begging.
So Liam's gone and patched up the relationship and said, "Hey, how about a world tour?"
Yeah.
Well, Noel gets all most of the.
He wrote everything,
royalties from
he?
All the songs. So poor Liam's just got the nice voice but doesn't get all the money. Anyway, we should talk about you a bit, Donnie. Joe, kick us off, mate.
Well, we could keep it in the 90s and sort of talk about how you sort of got going in tri, Tim. And when I actually don't personally know this, like, what did you start as an athlete? Like, was it you were a runner, or were you a swimmer, or just straight into triathlon, which is probably unusual for our generation, I'd say.
No, I definitely wasn't a triathlete. I swam from a young age, local swim club. And then I swam in a squad called Tadpoles, and then you moved up to Frogs, and then B squad and A squad. And when I was in B squad, I think I must have been about 12, 13, kind of like we got out and A squad got in. And I just really remember there was a coach called Malcolm. And before every swim, like as we're getting out, he would just shout this name, Spencer. And basically one of the swimmers would run halfway down the pool and dive in every session, as opposed to just jumping at the end. And that was Spencer Smith. I joined my local. I started to. Someone said, "Oh, you're a half decent runner because you do cross country running at school." But I wasn't a member of a club, so then I joined a running club. It's an odd. It depends how deep you want to go, but it's a very, very lucky, odd story of being in the right place at the right time, because I grew up near a place called Bushy Park, And there was an agent there called Kim McDonald, who's not around anymore. Now the company's called Pace Management. And he was one of the first guys that brought the Kenyans over to Europe. And how they could stay in Europe was they got a student visa at St. Mary's University, which is near Bushy Park in Southwest London. And that's where my parents went to uni, and that's where I grew up. And so every morning going to swimming, I'd see this pack of Kenyans walk into this park. Joe, you've definitely been to Bushy Park. And then, you know, then they would run around there. So I joined this running club. And after about, I don't know, 8 months, there was this skinny kid who couldn't speak much English, joined my running club from Somalia. And that was Mo Farah. So I realized pretty soon I was not going to be the best runner. I wasn't going to be the best runner. Having all these Kenyans around and then this little kid who's like 4 years younger than me, 3 years younger than me, just smashing me. So yeah, I then joined a local tri club called Thames Turbo, which Stewie Hayes was a member. And I swam with Stewie. And then, yeah, 92, I did my first ever duathlon. And then, yeah, that's the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow. I'm glad I asked that question. I had no idea. That's quite a story. Very, very interesting insight there.
It's funny just how, you know, you having brushes with greatness so early on. And I think a lot of us, it's like you realize how good someone is in a single sport and you're like, well, I'm pretty good at all three, so maybe I'll stick with that.
Totally. Two kids went to my school, a guy a year younger than me called Sam and Ben. They became my best mates. One of them used to beat Mo, and then the other one went to the Commonwealth Games. So I was like the fourth best in our county, top 30 in the country for cross country, but I was only the third best in my school. And I'm like, fuck.
You picked the wrong
school. So I was like, yeah, I'll do triathlon. But as you said, that triathlon wasn't huge. I mean, you know, I would say I'm doing a triathlon at the weekend and the PE teacher would be like, what the hell is that? Is that like horse riding? They genuinely like had no idea, like in the early 90s, what triathlon was.
In the early 90s, did you get, like, was there the federation and did they pick you up early and did you work with them pretty early on?
Oh, no, that did not exist.
Yeah.
So the team manager was a guy called Mick English and he was an ex-Navy. He had love and hate tattooed on his knuckles. And then you must have heard of a head coach called Dan Salcedo in float. He went to break. Well, many years later, they had a big argument and he headbutted him. I love that story. I just love it. At a race. But that's kind of, you know, the other guy in charge was a guy called Dave Bellingham, who was a parole officer. And they were just like mad keen triathletes. Like in 93, I went to the European Duathlon Champs as a youth in Finland. And like you had to pay your own flight. You had to buy your own kit. You know, even in 1998, when I won my junior world title, there was no such thing as funding. It wasn't till after that it became an Olympic sport and all the Aussies came over to take our money.
It's almost like racing ITU. It's almost like racing ITU long course world champs for Triathlon Australia at the moment.
Well, isn't Joe Skipper an illegal case with British triathlon?
Isn't he American? He's racing.
Yeah, his current license is American.
Oh, really?
Oh,
please,
no.
Please don't.
Actually, I want to get clarity on that. What's actually happened with that? Is he? So he was upset with them.
You're asking me for? I can make it. No, I heard he got given a race suit that eventually they said he had to buy, and he obviously raced in it. Got an invoice, ignored it, and they said, look, you know, you have to be in good standing with your federation. Because he said, no, I'm not paying for it. He's not in good standing. So I don't think they issued him a pro license, but it's pretty easy to get a pro license from America.
This is what are you trying to say about American pros, Donnie?
There's a lot of them. I mean, no, don't get me wrong. They're, there's always a pyramid, but their pyramid isn't like their pyramids like that. The top is good, but there's
Keep going.
That's true. Come on. You guys have raced there. I mean, why?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, you definitely, a lot of the pros, they definitely welcome them in. And I don't know whether, when I initially went there, I thought, oh, this is a bit weird. Like, these guys wouldn't win their age groups in Australia. And then the more
turns out they hadn't.
But the more I thought about it, I'm like, well, you know, they're not going to stick around. It's a great way of getting people to see whether they can rise to the challenge or not. So I'm not sure whether, you know, obviously you don't want too many crowding the start line, but if there's, yeah, in some ways it's got its pros and cons. So I'm not against it.
It's becoming a bit of an issue now with, I think, Oceanside a few of the bigger names couldn't get into the race. And then also, I think it was Boulder
Texas
as well.
Texas Ironman.
Yeah, that was one too.
Alistair Brownlee couldn't get in because the list was full. You don't get me wrong, I'm not against like lots of pros, but like you were saying, Clint, it's kind of like, you know, when you've got guys who have won multiple Olympic medals, have gone 7:38 for an Ironman, and 3 weeks before this, they can't get a start. That's I think, and I think things will change. This pro series,
the pro series, I think, has a lot to do with that. Yeah, I think people have gone, oh well, I'll have a go. I just need to get race a lot of Ironmans, and maybe I can make $5,000 at the end of the year. Which I love what Ironman are trying to do. And but if like some of the top tier athletes can't get into the big races, then yeah, teething problems first year, but hopefully they keep throwing money at it.
I think
oh hell yeah, the pros deserve it. Jesus.
I think that's a real problem, obviously, and especially when there are so many pros that it can't end up a fair race too. So there's got to be a middle ground somewhere. But I've always thought, you know, there should be that first tier and second, like ITU races.
Yeah.
Oh.
Tim's left us to our own.
He's left the building.
He's had enough.
Yeah.
He's filling in his pro license. recording it as well, or is this still recording?
It just came up and said, "You are the host now." So we'll see what happens.
Excellent. Yeah, we didn't need him anyway. Which Tim is this about anyway?
Yeah, I've longed for this day, guys. It's my time to shine.
It is.
block him, and then come in again.
We'll give him a minute or two and see if he comes back. But yeah, that was certainly the races like Oceanside and Boulder, some of the pro times were like, I won't say laughable, but they were like they weren't pro level, right? Like you can't expect to be competitive anywhere when it's when you're going like close to 5 hours in a pro field.
But I guess Ironman don't mind it because everyone's buying when I was a pro, it was like what, $1,000, $1,200. I'm sure it's closer to $1,500 license. So if they've got an extra, like, you know, 80 pros, that's an extra $80,000 in their pocket.
I guess the flip side of that, bud, is if those guys were still in age groupers, they're paying $600 per entry.
True. Yes, they're doing plus qualifying for Kona, which is even more.
Well, I've heard from plenty of age groupers that aren't winning like 70.3 in their age group, but they're like, oh, I'm going to get my pro license because I want to race X amount of races next year. And I just have to pay the $1,000 and I can do whatever Ironman or 70.3 I want. So back to your point, Tim, it's like, there's got to be they'll have to figure something out.
But then Ironman have never had a criteria, as far as I know. You just had to show a letter from a federation saying I am a pro. And literally the letter you get from British Triathlon, it's like, you get one letter, I can just change the date and they're going to, you know, 2024, 2025, and Ironman are going to accept it. They're not, almost Ironman need their own criteria of some sort.
I remember, I think it was 2019. There was two guys who did Ironman Australia they were pros from Singapore, and they went, I think it was 11:45 and 12:15, and the
male,
and they someone got to the bottom of the story, and it turns out they had done exactly that. They decided that they were having a gap year, and they were going to travel all over the place and do all the races they wanted to do. And they thought, well, what's the cheapest way of doing this? Let's find the easiest place to get our pro license. And then we can just do all the races for free, which is absolutely genius.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, like, don't hate the player. That's the system. That's the system, I guess. But in England, it's quite hard, only because we don't have many 70.3, like even non-branded races. And you need, there are only, they call them gateway races. So you either need to win it and then you're automatically in, no matter your time. Or if it's got a small pro race, you've got to finish within a percentage of the winner. But it's, again, it's just the first person. So if Joe and I have a sprint finish, Joe wins, he gets the pro license. Even though I'm half a second behind him, I don't get the pro license.
Yeah, that's the same in Australia from, years ago. I don't know what it is now.
Yeah, that's how they used to be in Australia.
Hang on, we might have Reed back.
Reed might need to know these rules if he's going to get another license one day. Because he's going to have to, like, apply to Triathlon Australia.
Surely he's got British heritage.
Yeah,
yeah, we can hear you, but thank God we can't see you.
Hey, Tim, do you still have a professional license? Out of curiosity. No, not you. Well, it's not about you, Tim. It's about the other team.
Oh, sorry. We work with Do you still got a pro license, Johnny?
Well, no. No, and yes, because I think in the British Federation, if you've like won a world title, you've been to the Olympics, I think you've kind of got a pro license. But hell, am I racing pro again? I'm not like an athlete like, say, like Sebi, who says in 6 years I'm going to retire. I'm going to do this year, and then, you know, that's not my cup of tea. I'm quite happy just to drift off into the sunset.
That's interesting, though. Yeah, some pros, huge names in the sport, didn't officially retire. They sort of just, they've stopped racing, but there was no official retirement. As far as I know, someone like Crowe, I don't think ever really announced its retirement. I might have missed yours, Donnie, but I'm not sure if you did. No. I just needed to move on, even though I didn't do half as much. Even what of what you guys did. I need to like call it.
I never wanted to fully hang it up because, you know, just every time you'd be having one of those good training sessions, you'd be like, I've still got it. I can make a comeback.
Then you wake up the next day and can't get out of bed.
Yeah. Reedy,
you're a lot younger than us as well.
Reedy gets like 3 nights of sleep, or the kids are away for the weekend or something, and Monday he's making a comeback.
There's been a few announcements to Clint of the comeback, and then of like 50 hours a week work and kids and stuff sort of gets in the way.
Sprint distance.
It's just like, he always comes back for the world champs at Byron Bay there, mate, the sprint distance world champs.
So speaking of like your world champs and obviously your ITU success, and if you covered this while my computer died, I'm really sorry, but you know, you were a phenomenal ITU athlete and known particularly for your run, Donnie. I was chatting to Scott from who runs the app Fuelin, and we got really into like race weights, and obviously you got to being such a good runner through, I'm guessing, lots of like run training, run volume. When you look at Frodeno when he won gold and when you were winning ITU races, you looked obviously extremely skinny. What was the thought process around race weight and getting to race weight? Because I know we haven't really touched on it in depth on the podcast with a lot of athletes. And I know for myself, I pushed myself to the limit for a couple of races there to get into a run shape that I thought would win a world title. Talk to me about, what was the game like back then? Do you think it was healthy long term? Would you change anything? That sort of stuff.
No, it definitely wasn't healthy because we weren't educated. Now we know, so the last 10 years, like body composition and, you know, race weight is understood better. When I was younger, it was a case of how light can I be to run as fast as I can without losing power in the swim. You know, I'd look at the calendar, and if there were wetsuit races, I knew I could be a kilogram and a half lighter than if there were no wetsuit races. And
if I click video, the video starts.
Wow.
This isn't your first podcast, is it?
It's a professional show, mate.
I love it. Oh, dear.
Sorry, go on, Ronnie.
And it was.
Without losing power. That was really interesting about the swim too, because I've always said the same thing to people, but I hadn't heard other people implement that.
I was never a natural swimmer. I had a really high, I was like super fit. So I had like 21 strokes a length, and I could just wrap that over and over and over. So again, I didn't have that great core, but in terms of holding that position. So it was just, so again, the lighter I got, the quicker I had to turn the arms over to the point where it wasn't working. And again, you know, like there wasn't the training nutrition that was around now. We didn't, you know, no one was having, you know, you'd have a gel and a gel on the bike and a caffeine gel, and you know, just at the end of the bike, early on the run, in a short, in an Olympic distance, and training. It was, I mean, like, yeah, you're basically, I was probably on a diet, not a diet, or watched what I eat for most of my ITU career. And knowing what I know now, yeah, I mean, God, you know, it's like, yeah, I've got a big session, massive bowl of pasta, kind of like, you know, oh, I've got a few easy days, salad, you know, it was basic. And again, you know, there wasn't much kind of like, the funding wasn't huge back then in terms of the support structure. It was, you know, your stipend and your travel budget. Back then there was a World Series, unlike now. So we were literally flying all over the world 7, 8, 9 times a year. So that's where the federation money kind of went to. We did big training camps in the winter, being a Northern Hemisphere like federation. But yeah, things like nutrition wasn't particularly looked at as far as I can remember through Sydney, even Athens, really, you know, up until 2004.
And then I guess on that, when you transitioned to Ironman racing, did your thought process change around how your body composition was made? Like, did you try and get more powerful and therefore eat a little bit more, or how'd you go about that?
Yeah. I mean, again, by end of 2012 was when I kind of said, you know, yeah, these brownie brothers are bloody good, the bastards. And I genuinely didn't want to be a domestique. So I moved to Boulder in 2013, started working with Julie Dibbons, and it was very much, you've got to fuel the session. The sessions were getting longer, you need more fuel. But just everyone's education, even back then, 2013, I mean, it was 11 years ago, was so much better than 2003, 1993 when I started. So it was easier. And again, it was more sensible, more balanced, more protein. I was doing a lot more gym, more specific work, specifically on the bike. You know, the first year, Julie couldn't understand why I wasn't winning everything. I'd race Joe in, what was it, Quasi? Red Free Quasi in the middle of Park, in the middle of nowhere with Richie Cunningham. And Julie, I remember going there, she goes, Tim, no one's done miles like you have on Monarch and all of this. And, you know, it was that stupid stagger rule in the draft, not the single. Oh my God, I'm going, what the hell? Anyway, I came off, I think there was maybe one or two off the front, came off the bike with the lead pack. And they're like, yeah. And literally within like 5K, it's like, bye boys. And I just went backwards. And again, so, you know, it was like, well, how much did you eat on the bike? Oh, wow. And now 100 grams an hour. Back then, Jesus, it was like, yeah, 2 gels and a bottle of a drink. I don't know how much it had in it. It was just an energy drink you shook up. And you know, so I definitely learned my hard lessons in some of my early 70.3s for sure.
Yeah. And we definitely didn't want to help him because we were like, nah, that's good, Donnie. 2 gels is perfect. Yeah.
In fact, might be a bit too much.
Guys, yeah, you're probably having too much. Just water. Yeah.
We interrupt another riveting episode of Triathlon Therapy to plug our sponsors. We've got First Home Specialists, the best in the business. If you're looking at getting your first home, please make sure to reach out to them and let them know that you heard about them from Triathlon Therapy Podcast. Of course, Nerd Belts, the best in hydration belts. They've been good and they're only getting better and better. If you're not fueling and hydrating throughout your race and having it on hand, I think you are really setting yourself up for not maximizing all the training that you've done and realizing your potential for that particular event. Get your Nerd Belt on. And of course, the RPG membership, for less than a Morton gel a week, you'll get daily advice around training. We answer member questions. We have amazing discounts and you can be a part of a lot of the pre and post-race activities at popular events around Australia. Get involved and thanks for listening.
The other thing we did some deep digging on you, Donnie, was, you know, for, you know, everyone thinks Ironman races are, you know, sort of tough guys and everything, but I've been told that your wife has to come in when you go into the dentist and hold your hand to support you, or maybe it's vice versa.
It's vice versa. It is like, if my wife, Kelly, has a fill-in, like she has to fully take a Valium and then get sedated. Okay. And that's fine in England, but honestly, in America, I think we were there seven and a half years. We spent about 40 grand on dentists, and it was no big, it was just fillings, because it's so, you go to this dentist for this dentist for this. It's Yeah, no, I'm fine with all that stuff. Yeah, but my wife, bless her, Kelly, she's not the I love it how these things no, that would, I bet that's from Liz Blatchford.
She's
probably taking Kelly to the dentist, actually.
We've got a team of people who look through all this stuff, mate, and they tell us all the information.
You lived in the US for quite a few years, and obviously Joe, you've lived there as well. I read an article the other day.
Are you living in the US now, Joe?
No, living in Melbourne, actually.
I didn't know that.
Just this year.
I read an article the other day and it resonated with me, and I was interested in both your guys' thoughts that the US is a third world country playing dress up as a first world country. What are your thoughts about that? In my time in Boulder, I sort of just saw the level of poverty sort of gradually increasing with homelessness and things like that. I was interested in what your guys' thoughts were.
Well, in Whole Foods, you don't see any of it. So.
No.
I mean, look, come on, Boulder's a bit of an anomaly, isn't
it? It's a bubble within a bubble. It's like,
it's a bit like Noosa, isn't it? I haven't been to Noosa for bloody 15 odd years, but it's not like the rest of Queensland, isn't it?
It's pretty nice.
I hope no one, you don't live in Noosa.
No. But we're in a bit of a bubble here too. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I just felt, even in my time from like 2010 through to, you know, when I was last there in 2023, I just felt like the gap between rich and poor in the US was becoming more and more noticeable. And I just was curious whether you guys, especially you, Joe, who was there for such a long time, whether you had noticed that or whether it was just something, maybe because I kept coming back every year or every second year, it was more noticeable for me. But living there,
in the 16 years I was there, can change considerably. And you speak to people back in 2008 when I got there and they were saying the same thing. And it's just been this trajectory that, I don't know, Boulder's one of the most livable cities in America, if not the world, and people are drawn there. And now with the tech companies coming there, it's really an unaffordable place to live. And I think aspiring pros that want to go there now, it's not really a possibility. I was really lucky. I came in just before it really went crazy, and I could still rent a room for $500 a month. Now, no chance. So I came there at a really good time, and got out maybe at a good time too. I don't know. No, I love Boulder.
I'd be quite happy to move back to Boulder. We really loved it. Like, we had a great community, especially you had it at the end, Joe, but we had it right from moving there with our daughter, kind of like outside of triathlon, through school and soccer tots and swim lessons. So we had my wife really enjoyed it as well, but it is different. I mean, it's such a, when I was there, I think the average house price, like officially, was like over $1 million. I mean, like, that's insane.
So did you move there to chase the, like, once you decided you're going to go to long course, is that when you moved there to work with Julie?
100%. So I'd been there in 2002. I used to be coached by a Russian coach, actually, called Dr. Nicholas Romanov, the pose method of running. So, he coached me, not just running, but everything. And he was doing some research. He's based in Coral Gables, but he was doing some research there. So I went there in 2002 and I was like, wow, this is brilliant. But my wife wasn't so sure. So then we went October 2012 for a week. And she was like, yep, okay, let's do it. So we moved there April the 3rd. And by early May, we were almost divorced because we rented somewhere fully furnished because we didn't know where we wanted to live. I told her 300 days of sun. This is amazing. They got 44 inches of snow in April. And she was like, what the hell? She goes, I know what you said. But I was like, oh, shit, it's not even winter and we're getting this.
Spring snow. It's real. Yeah.
I mean, look, if you ask, if I'm at an airport in England and I've got my bike, maybe not now because I'm old, but when I'm younger, they go, oh, what do? I do triathlon. They'd go, oh, wow, have you been to the Olympics? They don't know what Ironman is. There's no sponsorship in our country for Ironman 70.3. Well, in America, you've got a bike. First of all, they go, oh, are you in a band? No, it's a bicycle. And then they're going to say, oh, have you been to Kona? You know, it's just, I can't speak German, so I couldn't move to Germany. So, you know, I knew if I wanted to make it, and I really like altitude, and I was fed up of going to the Swiss mountains and then going to South Africa, you know, when my daughter, she wanted to go to school. So Boulder had this 300 days of sun a year. There were a lot of races over there. The 70.3 was with those 500 point, 750, 1500 point races. They were all kicking off. So that was 100% why we moved. And I knew Julie, I'd spoke to her. You know, we went to the Olympics together. I knew her when she was an amateur. I think when I won the junior title or the world title, she won the world amateur title at ITU at the same time for Great Britain. I wanted to work with her. So yeah, it was a no brainer.
Do you remember, like, it seems like a lot of the guys who come out of ITU, when they first come into 70.3 and Ironman, they've still got those fast twitch fibers and really like have a lot of speed, and then they steadily just get rid of them. Do you remember how much your, like, the specific differences in your training when you went from ITU racing into the 70.3 and Ironman distance?
Oh, it came, I don't mean easier, but I do mean easier and simpler. You know, if I was training for ITU, say you got 10 times a K with a minute rest and you want to hit 245s, as soon as I go 246, 247, I'm like, this session's bullshit, it's over. But what the hell? In that 70.3 Ironman, if you want to hit, I don't know, say 305, 310, if it's 315, it's still, you know, so the focus wasn't so much on the specificity of the training. It was more on the overall load on my body and the stress, because my body wasn't stressed for 4 hours, which was then was a good 70.3 time. You know, it was a really good body for an hour racing and like 1 hour 45, 1 hour 50. And it took a while for me to kind of shift that, especially the bike, you know, going from a 55, 60 minute bike where you're getting lots of rest to, you know, at 90K of consistent pedaling. That was where I struggled. Definitely. That was the thing that took the longest to change for me.
And you did spend some time when you were coached with Julie with Matt Bottrell as well, if I understand right. They were sort of co-coaching for some of that time. Is that because the bike wasn't quite clicking? You sort of like, I know Julie brings in Matt quite a lot with in terms of aerodynamics and position and stuff like that. But tell us about your relationship with Matt a little bit, because I know you live quite close to each other, I think, as well.
Yeah, we live about 10K away. So okay. We don't ride anymore, but well, he rides. I don't ride so much. I just run. So basically I had a coach from a long time ago called Craig Ball, who was a pro back in the, like, you know, around Sydney Olympic time, really good friend. He left the sport and whatnot. And I was worked with other people, Brett Sutton amongst others. And he said, oh, I'm overweight, I'm getting back into it. My God, I found this cycling coach that's amazing. Tim, you've got to have a call with him. I think he can really, really help you with your 70.3. And I was like, no. He said, no, you must. So I had a call with him when I was living in America, and it was like 2.5 hour call. And I was just like, that's exactly what I need to do. And I was like, shit, how do you speak to a coach who is a world-class athlete, a good, really good friend, and, you know, and say, look, I love you swimming and running, but I think we can add this in. You know, it is not many people play well with ball, and it takes a bloody good coach who can listen. And I was so fortunate that, and again, this is all transatlantic, but Julie and I, we jumped on a call with him, and we kind of gave it a go. We tried some things, and then they kind of set up a WhatsApp group that I wasn't involved in, and, you know, they could see Training Peaks, and, you know, and that was definitely the transformation for me from I was winning podium at 70.3s, but it was at the end of 2015, I think I qualified for Kona, but I did terrible. And then I got a medal at the world 70.3s, but my biking just wasn't accessing my running. And yeah, we just changed it massively. And from that, I'm not saying everyone, but then everyone started to work with Matt. And
yeah, I remember he definitely
changed the game.
I actually remember seeing you in Boulder, Donnie, training by yourself all the time on the bike. And thinking, oh, poor fella, like he's on a different bike. He's on a different bike plan. And then you went and like started tearing everyone's legs off. And I was like, didn't feel sorry for you anymore after that. I was like, yeah, he's a smart guy.
But it just goes to
my training.
Yeah, but it just goes to show, like, someone like Julie, who's open to that. It just, was so important, and to coaches to have the confidence in their own coaching to sort of say when they maybe could outsource something. That's really important, because look, it's three sports, four really in strength training as well, and there's nutrition. You're not one coach cannot know it all. So no, and I think Julie, that was sort of like the trailblazer with that, I think, with coaches outsourcing. And I think and she's gone on to sort of use that, as well as she's got someone, a physiologist, that now does a lot of testing within her squad and stuff. And look, you can see the results. It really does make a big difference.
Yeah, I think the key to being really good at any profession is knowing you where you're not the expert, and being okay with going, hey, we need to ask someone else about this, or saying, hey, I don't know the answer. Let's find out. Let's find someone who's really good at it, or I know this much, but maybe there's something more I could learn.
And also, like her being very receptive to that, like no doubt, long term, that's made her a way, way, way better coach because of the little things that she'd pick up along the way that all of a sudden she would be a lot more knowledgeable about cycling. So
yeah, and Julie, I'm sure wasn't sort of she didn't just say, okay, the cycling's done. That's one thing I don't have to worry about. She learned from that, like, and Julie coached me for a short time as well, and her knowledge of cycling, I was blown away because I worked with her much later. But what she learned through coaching, working with Bottrell, was amazing, and she's able to apply that to all her other athletes as well. So, it just took the level to it. Yeah, just took it up a notch or two.
And she, you know, don't get me wrong, it wasn't a case of she did my swim, bike, and then I worked with a lady called Amy who used to work under Erin for S&C, which did the whole squad. We did group sessions. It wasn't a case of Matt did it. There were definitely times when Matt said, I needed to do this. And Julie said, no, he definitely needs to do that. And I remember Matt wasn't a big believer of like a 6-hour easy ride, but Julie says he has to do at least one or two in an Ironman build. And without a doubt, as much as I didn't particularly like, and do you know what? This is for you, Tim. I'd always do them on my own. I had this 201K loop. I'd start at Coot Lake, go out to Fort Collins, past, what was that nice cow yogurt, the yogurt place?
Noosa.
Really bloody expensive. Noosa. Past Noosa, up this big mountain, do 30 minutes at race pace, and then come back and do a 10K run around the lake. And I always had
a Pewter Canyon loop.
Yeah, is that what it is? Yeah. And then I'd go to Snarps, and if I have a good one, I'd get a Mexican Coke and a big chicken sandwich. Hey, if I didn't, my wife was like, oh, God.
I mean, obviously, there's some... I think we'd have to talk about your world record Ironman performance. Would you say that was like the culmination of everything coming together for you in Ironman, that performance? Or was there another day that you were just as proud of? Or
Over Ironman, definitely. I mean, Matt wrote down what bike time I was going to do before the race and didn't tell me. And he was like 82 seconds off. So we knew the course. I got second there the year before. We know the swim is fast. It's an M shape, but the in a bay, and the water goes across. So you kind of, you've always got that current. Brazilian, Igor Amarelli, and there was a young Brazilian pro who probably shouldn't have been a pro, but he was a really good swimmer. So thank you very much. I knew I was riding well. I had to get away. That was definitely like the most complete Ironman performance. That and probably my first Ironman, because I was so naive. It wasn't particularly fast, but I just kind of rocked up to Ironman Mallorca 3 weeks after getting a medal at World 70.3s, and I won it. And that qualified me. Kona was in like 3 weeks' time, but it qualified me a year and 3 weeks later. So, that was definitely a big, big, big race for me. And I raced for a Brazilian team back then, Team Bravo. So, yeah, it was definitely, special memories.
And then obviously you had a horrible accident, and your whole triathlon career was sort of tipped on its head.
Ended.
If you like. Yeah. Can you share as much as you want to share about, what happened and, just the process of dealing with everything you had to go through, I guess. Maybe not everything if you don't want to share it, but
no, I mean everyone, lots of people know quite most things, really. I mean, I definitely think the first kind of like 4 days is not so much emotion at all. It's very practical, kind of like, you've got this injury, whatever it is, and for me it was just a broken neck. You need to get it sorted one way or another. Initially, I remember, until they told me I had a broken neck, I still thought I could race. Julie was in hospital with me, and Franco, who was my manager. And I remember I had x-ray and I had scan, and they took blood tests. They knew what blood type I was. And I'm like, why do they want to know that? And then I realized, oh, fuck, just in case I got to operate and I need a transfusion or something. And then I was going in for a a CAT scan. So I got wheeled out in the bed, and I'm like, I wasn't on morphine then because I still thought I might race. I just, my shoulder and knee was sore, but that was it really, because my neck was like in this brace. So they wheeled me out into this, and you're laying on, I would say silk, but polyester kind of like cloth. And then they slowly, you know, someone gets near your ankles, your hips and your head, and they drag you onto the MRI CAT scan machine. I was in there. And anyway, you know, you, it's really loud. And then they go, right, we're finished. We're coming in. And I was like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck? And I go, no, no, don't move. And I go, yeah, yeah, no worries. Someone grabbed my ankle. Someone grabbed my shin. Someone grabbed my knee. Two people grabbed my femur. Two people grabbed my hip. And I'm like, well, there's only three people dragged me on. And I think that's when, fuck me. They obviously, there's some serious stuff here. And there was literally like eight or nine of them slowly moving me. What before? They were like, next, just another Ironman on our island, messing it up. And that's when they told me. And I remember, wow. I started to kind of like, and they literally had to, this nurse had to like, not sit, but really push on my chest, because I was kind of like in this panic, hyperventilating. Julie's crying, Franco is. God, I haven't talked about this for such a long time. Yeah, then I was like, fuck it, give me the morphine. So they put me on morphine, and that's when I did a message to everyone. I think they played at the pro meeting. And I remember people going, God, he can't be that bad. And it was because literally I'd just been injected with this massive shot of morphine. And again, my wife wasn't on the island, so we had to get news to her. Kind of, how do you tell her? My son had just been born not that long ago. So she was at home with Hugo and Matilda. And literally, how do you say, don't worry, he can't race. He's got a broken neck. You know how that. So yeah, I think Julie and Franco did a lot of that. And then the next day I had to fly home to see a specialist, because I could have gone to Honolulu, but if they needed to operate, I was probably stuck in Honolulu for which isn't a bad thing, but I'd rather be in Boulder with my family. So yeah, that first bit was pretty tough. And then it was just painful. I mean, when anyone's screwing metal titanium screws into your skull, you know, the codeine, I was only had a local when they screwed them in. Like, so you guys will appreciate, I'm sure you've heard me say this before somewhere, but that is talked to how tight the screws are to 8 Newton meters. So if you think you do your carbon seat post to 6 and it cracks it. And I was like going, how the hell do you know 8, not 7? How many skulls did they freaking crack? yeah, so, and it was hard. I mean, you know, then it sunk in. Obviously, I would have won Kona. That would have been my crown and glory of the Ironman, et cetera, et cetera. But, yeah, it was tough. There were some definitely dark days where, you know, it took a while for me to realize. But pain was just, I mean, you got open wounds. They had to get tightened because they kept on coming loose. So yeah, it wasn't, I wouldn't recommend it. Have the fusion.
And then post that injury, Donny, how long until you went back to the island, and how was that?
Well, I went back 12 months because I qualified to race as a pro. So I did a Costa Rica 70.3 and 1. In fact, Ryan Fisher, he was second, an Aussie guy. And that gave me enough points. And then I think I had to get top 8 in Hamburg Ironman. So I went to Ironman Hamburg, the swim got cancelled. So we ended up running like over, I think like 50K. It was like 8K.
Don't then start then the reading bike, this
and
stuff.
Then 42K. Jesus Christ. And I finished 9th, and I had to finish 8th because you had to be top 50 in the world. And then I went to Copenhagen and I got rotten guts. And that was like 2 weeks later, and that was it. I wasn't going. I was ranked 51 or 52, whatever the cutoff was. I was one, and then Ironman phoned me up and go, oh, we give you a wild card. And I go, are you joking? I mean, if you'd have told me this months ago, I wouldn't have done all this stupid stuff, and I would have prepared. And I said, no, I don't want it. I don't want it. It's fine. Thanks. And I flew back to Boulder, and then about 10 days later, Heather Fiora phoned me, who was then pro athlete liaison, and she said, oh, one of the guys has not taken his spot, so there's a roll down, and I don't think they've paid anyone to not take their spot. And yeah, so I took the spot, and I think I was 38, but for me it was just about finishing. I mean I wore part of the run. I had hip issues because my head wasn't sat like that, so my whole body had kind of like was moving differently. And that's when the chapter was closed for me. Kind of like, I knew I'd never go back to the island, as much as I had sponsors, so I wanted to carry on racing and so forth. But it was, I had young family. I knew I knew how close I was to what I believed was a position to fight for a podium in 2017. As I know, I'm sure Joe and Tim, you've been there as well. And, you know, fuck, man, it's like I couldn't even start the bloody race. So, yeah, but I've been back every year and I'm going back this year as well. So I do enjoy going there. It is, and the junction is impossible now. There's a central reservation now, so no one can cut across and take a cyclist out in the cycle lane.
I still send all our athletes out of town now to ride since 2017, Donny. There's no riding in. I mean, it seems to happen every year because there's so many tourists to town and so many people riding and driving cars that aren't aware of what's happening. So, yep, they all start from out near the Energy Lab somewhere to minimize the risk.
Yeah, we, all the athletes I coach that go there, they all stay in Waikoloa, and this year's no different.
So, obviously, what's your role? Thanks for sharing that too, Donny. Like, it's, you know, I'm sure we've heard it before, but it's still like such an incredible thing you had to overcome. And, you know, obviously, I think everyone listening is just still gutted for you that you didn't get that opportunity. But you've obviously.
Jan's lucky.
What's that? Sorry?
Yeah.
Jan's lucky.
Talk to us about what you're doing now post-racing. I guess, yeah, more with your job with Super Tri and, yeah, how it's all working and, yeah, anything you can tell us about that.
So I got involved in Super Tri in COVID. So they got the go-ahead in COVID to have the what was then the Arena Games, now Super Tri E in London, but very, like, in a COVID environment. And I don't think they got enough athletes and they needed some kind of like story. So what about, Tim, you used to do it, St. George Formula One. I did that back in the 90s in Australia, and one summer when it changed its name to that. And I was like, so I said, yeah, sure. You know, they came and did some filming at home and I went down and I made the final and finished. I feel bad because I didn't finish last. I finished 8 out of 9. But only because, can you remember Adam Bowden?
Yeah.
Well, his machine broke, so I didn't come last. But and then from there, I love working with them. And they said, hey, we're going to, you know, hopefully COVID ends and we're going to do some stuff. Do you want to do some commentary? I was like, yes. And that's how I got involved. And since then, my role is kind of like no set. I could do commentating. I do athlete contracts for them. You know, I source all the athletes. I work with a guy, a statistician, like a mathematician, to kind of like when we didn't have teams that were privately owned like they are now, to work out who's in which team so we can have fair, balanced racing. You know, a bit like the like the draft. So it's not always, you know, Real Madrid, Man City. And now I'm an owner of joint owner of one of the teams called Podium Racing. I'm really enjoying it. I mean, I love, you know, working with the younger athletes and, you know, seeing their passion and fire and they're like, yeah, I'm going to make it. And I'm going, yeah, not everyone's going to make it, but I love it. And you know, but I believe they really look after them well. They try and work with World Triathlon on the schedule. You know, everyone gets solid appearance fee and, you know, travel money and the prize money is over $1 million for 5 races. You know, I'm now part of a larger team that is, so we own the Chicago Triathlon, the Long Beach Triathlon and, Malibu in New York. We own the IP of Malibu, but that's a whole other story. and we are trying to, you know, kind of like launch in North America, kind of like mass participation, Olympic distance racing. It's a big, big drive and goal for Super Tri.
Well, for anyone listening, I think the thing that got me into triathlon was casually watching the St. George series that you're referring to and the Tui's Blue triathlon. Mm-hmm. And like, in my mind, it's the most watchable form of triathlon. So even now when I get on the bike, I still fire up Super League Tri from before and Super Tri now. And I just like watching it. And I just enjoy that short, fast stuff that I can do an hour trainer set to, and there's lots of action. So I think it's a fantastic concept and obviously seems to be heading more and more in the right direction. So cool to hear what you're doing with them. So, and now it's just private teams. So someone can just go, how did that, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but was it basically a team owner just comes in and says, oh, I want to buy X number of athletes to to represent my brand?
No, so they buy a franchise off Supertri, and it's not a case of saying, yep, I want to buy a franchise. You know, they're obviously due diligence on Supertri. It's got to be sustainable. And you know, next year, I think we're going to have a salary cap. So basically, Macca can't just buy everyone. Yeah, we're going to have a salary cap, and we're going to have, you know, there's a working committee with the owners and whatnot. And not all teams are sold. And again, you know, the plan is to have a spring season and then an autumn season, and then have two finals where the top two from each of those kind of like leagues then race in two races. But we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because we've seen that. Let's just do what we're doing really well, and then try and progress to get there. There's a guy called John Anthony who owns a coaching company in America called Podium Coaching, and that's why we're called Podium Racing. We've got some investors behind us, and now we've got the arduous task of trying to find sponsorship to cover travel, accommodation, you know, running a professional team, marketing. There's also going to be a license fee going forward, because obviously, you know, it cost over $1 million to put on a live production event for 2 hours, 20 minutes, which is the men and women with, you know, everything around it that Supertri have to cover. So that there is that as well. So, if you guys are interested, I can definitely connect you guys.
To
the right people.
I've been wondering, I've just had $1 million. I've been looking around. It's something to finally
throw it in. Yeah.
We might just
want a women's or a men's team, not both.
Yeah, we'll just take a bit out of the RPG offset account and we'll be okay.
Is this a million RPG Australian racing, or a million US?
A million rand. I really enjoy it. Yeah.
Hey, Donnie, I don't know if you guys have any last questions. Are you okay for me to wrap up? Well, thanks so much for coming on. Being an admirer from a distance, you know, didn't get to know you too well through your career, but every time I, you know, my brief interactions, I always thought, what a nice chap.
I was always riding on my own, you see.
Truth be told, he was thinking, what a weirdo. He's always on his own.
Yeah, that's it.
But no, like, absolutely legendary career, and obviously amazing to overcome everything you have. And thanks, Joe, for coming on too. We might get you on more, given that Steve McKenna just seems to have completely ditched the show he started.
That's fine. Whenever you want.
Love it.
Thanks, Clint.
Thanks, and guys.
Thanks, Donnie. Catch ya.
Cool, thanks for having me. Appreciate that. Cheers.
We'll see you in Kona, Donnie.